Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I'd like to welcome our guest co-host, Dr. Samir Arora. Welcome, Samir.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
On our show today, we're going to have a conversation with Dr. Brian Huggins and Dr. Mark Gwynn, who are with the University of North Carolina in senior leadership, about the Health Alliance and the work of value-based healthcare. First, though, let's have a conversation about some research that matters. And let's talk about the very first one, which is about hoarding. People who keep things have a really difficult time throwing them away. And we've talked about this on the show before. It's actually a significant medical problem for a lot of people. And a lot of people who don't hoard don't really understand, well, why do they have a hard time throwing away the junk mail, for instance, that comes? Well, they do.
Yes, so this new research has demonstrated important differences in how people with and without hoarding problems discard objects and the roles their memories play.
Yeah, this was actually in the journal Behavioral Therapy, and they show that, you know, if you have a really strong positive memory, which a lot of people do with things, I might have a strong positive memory over a picture. I may not be able to want to throw those pictures away. Well, the people who don't have hoarding, they may have a positive memory, but they're able to let go of it pretty quickly. You know, they're not attached to it a way that says, oh, I can't throw this away. And what we've discovered in through this research is that you might be able to alter how people think about those memories that might help the people with hoarding.
And according to the Royal College of Psychiatrists, hoarding can be a mental health problem in its own right. And the clutter associated with the hoarding can have profound effects on the lives of people.
Yeah, and I like this research because we know that hoarding doesn't respond to a lot of the medications we have available, but it can respond to cognitive behavioral therapy. They actually did this research with 2 dozen people who had hoarding and 2 dozen who didn't, and really saw the differences between how they can deal with these memories. Let's talk about our next research that matters. And this has to do with vaccinations. And it's all over the news, and we've had some special shows on vaccinations. But this is about an important element that I don't think we speak enough about. But it has to do with trust, not just trust in the provider, but trust in society. I found this striking.
Yes, and I found it striking too. It's actually intriguing research. The research has found that the trust in vaccines is actually highest in the poorer countries, but weaker in the wealthier ones.
For instance, France leads the world in mistrust of vaccines, one of the wealthiest countries on the planet. And we see that some of the poorest countries have very high rates of vaccine coverage. Well, does that mean that people in the higher wealth countries know more, so therefore they distrust more? Or does this mean that the false information on vaccines tends to get traction more in countries where it can be spread?
Yes, and as they say, sometimes too much information may not be good information. And we really don't want this false information to spread into some of these poorer countries. As they found in Afghanistan and Pakistan, false rumors about polio vaccines being part of Western plot have in recent years hampered global efforts to wipe out crippling diseases like polio.
And that, I think, is a disgrace. This was actually researched 140,000 people in 140 countries, 6% of parents, 188 million around the world, our children are unvaccinated. That was highest in China at 9%, Austria at 8%, Japan at 7%. Most of the world trusts their doctors and their nurses and their providers. And I think that's where you go for the information that's trustworthy. That's I think, the bottom line on this particular research. Our next research that matters has to do with Facebook. And this research suggests that Facebook posts are better at predicting some chronic diseases like depression or diabetes than the normal information that people get when they first go to their doctor's office. I find that striking.
This study is very interesting. I think what they were looking for was keywords on those Facebook posts and not necessarily looking for words like diabetes or anxiety. They were looking for certain different words which might mean different things. For example, as they mentioned, words like God or pray might mean that you have more potential to have diabetes.
Yeah, for reasons I wasn't fully certain of that one, but I could easily understand how putting words up about drink and bottle were actually more predictive of alcohol abuse. And they actually, in this particular study that was in the journal PLOS1+1, research out of Penn University and Stony Brook University, they actually had patients agree to let the researchers look at their social media posts. And then they did these studies to see that they were actually better at predicting the and diagnosing things earlier than the things, again, when people first come into the doctor's office. And they're trying to say, well, maybe people are willingly going to share their social media posts. I think privacy is a huge concern here. We already know that there's multiple breaches of privacy. I think mixing social media posts with health care, people could opt in, they could volunteer. That's one thing. But I think making sure that this is 100% volunteer, to me, that's a key and critical.
Yes, I completely agree. We don't want to invade privacies of individuals, for sure.
Speaking of privacy, our last research that matters is about asking patients who have skin diseases to bring their photos of their skin diseases with them, because sometimes things like maybe urticaria or kind of a rash that you have, by the time you get to the doctor, it may be gone and you think, well, was it really there? And then you're just describing it.
Yes, it makes perfect sense to me. Dermatology, for me, it's all pictures. And if your dermatologist can't see what you really had, then it must be difficult for them to give you a proper diagnosis, correct?
Yeah, this was actually in France, the 311 patients who had appointments for hives. So it was actually a specific condition. And I think it's different, you know, getting a picture of hives, which is easy to diagnose, than a picture of a mole, which may be much more difficult. Moles may not go away, but you may have had something that you took a picture of some sort of rash that was faint. You didn't take a great picture. It was really hard to get a high resolution. It may be helpful, but it raises questions like, how are you certain that it was the picture of the person who brings it in? What do you do with that picture? Right now, we have processes that we can record the photos. We wouldn't have a process to record a photo that's brought into us easily. It's time, it's expense. So in general, I'm sympathetic, but I also think, I'm not so certain always.
Yes, I completely agree with that. And again, keeping your photographs in your phones, confidentiality always plays a role. But at the same time, if you do want your physician to be able to look at what exactly you're going through, it might be of benefit.
Yeah, so if you got a rash that's coming and going, definitely take a picture.
Yes, absolutely.
If it's still there, go see the doctor. Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Mark Gwynn, Medical Director of the UNC Health Alliance and Associate Professor at the University of North Carolina, and Dr. Darren DeWalt, Board Chair of the University of North Carolina Health Alliance and Professor at the University of North Carolina, about the promise of value-based care. You're listening to Your Health. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
UNC Family Medicine's #2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Brian Huggins. Today on Conversations, Brian, we're talking with Dr. Mark Gwynn, President of the UNC Health Alliance and Associate Professor at the University of North Carolina, and Dr. Darren DeWalt, Board Chair of the UNC Health Alliance and Professor at the University of North Carolina, about the promise of value-based healthcare. Welcome, Dr. Gwynn and Dr. DeWalt.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Thank you. Absolute pleasure to be here.
You're leading major efforts at the University of North Carolina to improve the care that hundreds of thousands of people get really across North Carolina. Before we dive into what it means, what is value-based care, each of you tell us just a little bit about yourself. How did you get to a place, do you think, that you became leaders in changing the health of populations? Start with you, Darren.
You know, it's interesting. I never would have guessed that this was where my career would lead. I started my career in general internal medicine, practicing medicine, but also trying to understand why there were gaps in care, particularly for vulnerable populations, people with low literacy skills or people who don't have a lot of resources. And as I started studying that, I learned that to solve those problems, the healthcare part of solving that problem would involve making changes in practice. And that led me to really start to think about quality improvement and how do we measure whether healthcare is doing a good job. And as we start getting into that, we realize that there are changes we need to make to create better health for our patients. And since we're talking about value today, there are probably changes we can make that can lower the cost for our patients.
Nice.
So interestingly, my answer is going to be remarkably similar to Darren's. My first clinical job outside of residency was in rural North Carolina, where I experienced firsthand the barriers to care that many patients experienced, including transportation and paying for medications, making really difficult choices between paying for medications and healthcare versus paying for their electricity and food. And I've always been attracted to the gaps that we find throughout our healthcare system where our most complex, medically and psychosocially complex patients fall through. And I found over time that paying attention to those gaps is where we find our most vulnerable patients. And fixing those gaps in our healthcare system has been highly attractive and has felt impactful over time. And I've seen gaps in transitions of care between care settings, I've seen gaps in affordability. And I think fundamentally the work that we're doing is trying to make healthcare more affordable for everyone, for us as healthcare delivery systems, for patients, for payers, for everyone involved in the healthcare system. And I've really started to see that value-based care and in terms of care delivery, marrying that with payment mechanisms that allow us to deliver the type of care that we fundamentally know is right and is effective, that's where I feel impactful and that's where I really want to spend the rest of my time.
This is great history on both of you, and it's a really interesting topic. Terms like value-based care, fee-for-service, I mean, these are confusing terms. So maybe if you could explain a little bit, what is value-based care?
The simple formula that we talk about a lot is that value is the quality and experience of care divided by the cost of care. So that if you can drive up the quality and the experience of care for a person while maintaining or lowering cost, you're driving up value to the individual patient or person.
That's more value back to the person because that number's higher.
That's right.
Absolutely. And that is fundamentally the equation. I think how we realize that equation is really important, how we define what quality means and the measurements around quality, the outcomes, and how we define and measure what is an important outcome to healthcare providers, what's an important outcome to patients. The equation is simple. How we get to the equation, though, I think is quite complex, and that's where we spend a lot of our time.
So when I think back when I was a kid growing up in Atlanta, and I'm thinking about, you know, I was 13, 14, 15, and I was seeing my parents' internist, who happened to be a cardiologist, and I would get a stress test, an EKG, a chest X-ray, and an upper gastrointestinal almost once a year when I would come in. And I just assumed I was getting good value care. I thought it was good quality. I was pretty satisfied. I didn't know anything about the cost. What's wrong with that model? And is that emblematic of why we are where we are today? Because I assume and believe this was a good cardiologist.
I think ambiguity about the actual cost of care that we deliver is a fundamental problem. If we ask 10 doctors what a CAT scan costs, we'll get 10 different answers. If we ask 10 patients what a CAT scan costs, we'll get 10 different answers. So that type of ambiguity is certainly one of the factors that's led us to an overpriced healthcare system.
Why does that uncertainty lead to higher cost?
When we talk about value, inherent in that is then high value and low value. And the concept of low value care is an important one. So we have to know, Adam, when you went to see that cardiologist, was it important that you had a stress test? Were there good outcomes that stress test was going to provide? And if not, then we have to question, is it a good test? And is it important to do on an otherwise healthy young man? And that gets to the concept of low value care. So it's hard to think about because I, as a doctor, think that I provide the highest value care all the time. But I can tell you, in fact, I probably don't. And we need good data to tell us what is high value care and what's low value care.
When as a patient, isn't it better to get more tests? I mean, don't I want to know that there could be a disease lurking in there somewhere?
Well, you would like to know that if the test is good at detecting that disease, and that's a disease that we can do something about for you. Some tests that we do aren't as good at picking up disease as we're led to believe. And so it's really important for us as doctors to be aware of which test is a good test and which test is not giving us the information we need to take care of you. So I would say that no, just getting all tests is not always a good thing.
So when I come into the exam room, I come in to see a leader who understands what value-based care and is practicing it. What do I notice differently? Mark, let's start with you.
I think you likely have more conversations about the value of the, and not to overutilize the word value, but the value of the tests and diagnostic interventions and treatment strategies. What I've found myself doing more over time, especially over the past few years, is having more conversations about with patients about what is truly important to them, what are their goals in life and in their health, and trying to marry the right diagnostic strategy and treatment strategy to marry their goals. And often, that means not doing testing. Even if it might detect a cancer, they might not want to know about that. And if that marries their goals, then that's, I think that's reasonable. But I have many more conversations with patients about what they want and marrying the medical evidence to what they want.
Because I may actually have to pay. If you order an MRI, I may be paying a lot of money out of pocket nowadays. And so maybe those views are realistically important.
That's right. Patients really worry about that. In fact, Adam and Brian, you may have seen that in the New England Journal of Medicine, there was an article talking about what do Americans feel about healthcare costs. And it turns out that second to strengthening the economy, of which 70% of Americans said was very important for the next election, the next number one thing was the cost of healthcare at 69% of Americans. And what people are really worried about is how this affects their own personal financial health and their family's financial health. And so getting back to your original question of how does this feel different, I think Mark is so right about conversation. All of a sudden, the interaction with my patients is about how can we align your healthcare with what you want to have happen? And I now have space to say, you know, rather than just ordering a panel of tests, let's talk about which tests are going to help you right now. And let's get those.
So that's the quality component.
And it, you know, I also find myself having conversations with patients about different medications and really asking them, can you really afford these medicines? What are you not doing in your life to pay for your medications and making some adjustments based on that? The study that Darren quoted is really interesting. There's also a Pew Research poll that showed that 40% of patients with a newly diagnosed cancer were more concerned about paying for the cancer than the cancer diagnosis itself. That is fundamentally a different approach for us to have to take.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break, but we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Mark Gwynn and Dr. Darren DeWalt at the UNC Health Alliance and the University of North Carolina about the promise and the reality of value-based care. We're going to take a short break, but we'll be right back with Your Health. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we've been talking with Dr. Mark Gwynn and Dr. Darren DeWalt of the UNC Health Alliance and professors at the University of North Carolina about the promise of value-based care.
Gentlemen, we've been talking a lot about the patient level and how it affects the patient, but I'm a provider, and so I'm curious, how does value-based care affect the way that I would practice? What are the benefits? What are the disadvantages?
Well, Brian, it requires a different way of looking at healthcare and thinking about delivering healthcare. As we were talking about, a minute ago, we're really trying to align healthcare with the patient's values. And as a provider in a value-based care environment, my goal is to improve the health of that patient and keep the patient doing the things they want to do. That does not mean holding back care, but that actually may mean spending more time with my patients, answering phone calls and taking care of them in the community so that they feel like there is a resource that can help them make the right decisions about their health. We hope in a value-based care environment that physicians like us who are primary care physicians can serve as a fantastic resource for their patients, and that patients will be able to have more access to us and require less emergency care or other types of care that may be less comfortable for a patient. For example, last week I had a patient with really high blood sugar. And in an old system, they might have gone to the emergency room to deal with the blood sugar, but the patient's daughter knew to call me. And I said, you know, I don't think you have to go to the emergency room. Let's just try this out at home. And I talked her through it, and I took a couple extra phone calls that night. I'm not on call, but it was just a couple phone calls. I know the patient and family. We were able to save this elderly gentleman an emergency room visit because I was thinking about what's going to be the best thing for him. An elderly gentleman that's feeling okay is going to spend hours sitting on a gurney in the emergency room, and those emergency room doctors are fantastic, and they know how to treat that as well. But they're busy, and they're also dealing with other emergencies, so why not work on this with the patient's family and him to keep him out of the hospital?
And it likely would have been a $5,000 to $7,000 bill for a day in the hospital. I imagine you could have employed in this particular case a pharmacist and a social worker and another doctor or two as an outpatient. That's got to be a way of reducing cost.
You're exactly right, Adam. And to build on Darren's story and analogy, I think one of the most significant promises of value-based care is it allows us to build care teams differently than we've done before. And it really moves us into population management strategies. So when I think about complex patients who are at home and anxious and maybe have significant depression, have financial difficulties, maybe can't afford transportation, that's where a value-based payment system allows us to identify care managers, social workers, pharmacists that can really address some of the core barriers to care that many of our patients are facing. We had a really interesting gentleman on dialysis who, over time, we noticed was in the hospital quite a bit for fluid and volume overload. And it turns out he was missing one or two dialysis sessions every week. It happened to be on a Saturday every time. We had data to support that and to notice that pattern. And it turns out the local buses don't run on Saturday. And that's why he was missing his appointments. So it became a lot less expensive for us to pay for him on Saturdays to go to dialysis than to pay for the hospitalizations, the three or four hospitalizations that he had experienced already. And honestly, much better for him and his outcomes.
So you're putting much more money into potentially primary care to manage a population, but maybe reducing some of the costs that associated with emergency room or other high specialty care that maybe the patients need but didn't need at that point in time.
You know, patients are for sure going to need emergency rooms and specialty care, but we want to preserve access to those places and those physicians. Emergency rooms are overcrowded right now. If we can keep patients out, that allows other patients to get in. There are wait lists to see specialists in a lot of areas of North Carolina. If we can take care of these patients so that they don't need as many specialist visits, then we can open up access for patients who really need to get in.
So you talk about less hospitalizations, less ER visits, which sounds great for the patient, but isn't that how hospitals make money? I mean, if I live in rural North Carolina, is my hospital going to close because they're not going to get business anymore with value-based care?
There are two aspects of value-based care. There's value-based care delivery, And that's what we spent quite a bit of time talking about right now. But there's also value-based payment mechanisms, and that's the other half of the equation. And when we build the care delivery models, we become very attractive to payers like Medicare and Medicaid and Blue Cross and United and Cigna and others who want to pay us differently to provide that care because they know that in the long run, we can provide that care with high quality outcomes, but at lower cost. So it allows us to outreach to our rural communities in new and different ways. And to Darren's point, we have now payment mechanisms that incent us to provide virtual care, for example, into rural North Carolina for cardiology or other services that otherwise wouldn't have access to that type of specialist. And that's a different incentive. So the traditional model for how acute care hospitals have generated revenue is changing. And we just have to figure out how to get to the next step of revenue.
Let me ask Dr. Darren Dewalt, you first and also Dr. Gwynn. You are leaders, board chair and president, respectively, of the North Carolina Health Alliance, the UNC Health Alliance specifically. What is that doing, and what do you wake up each morning thinking about differently than if you weren't having that particular role?
Well, Adam, since you're starting with me, what is the Health Alliance and what do I think about differently? The Health Alliance, what we're trying to achieve is to bring physicians and hospitals and other facilities together to take accountability for the health of a population of patients. And we're trying to work together to optimize the health outcome to eliminate any wasteful medical care that could be going on. And we're looking for partners and payers and employers that want to work with us who also want their employees or their patients or beneficiaries to achieve the best health outcomes at a reasonable cost. And by working together, we think we can achieve that. When I wake up every morning, I think about the transition that we've just been talking about from being a provider focused on how many visits can I do in a day because that's how I get paid, to being a doctor that's very focused on the health outcome for the patient. And if you look at the world that way, it enables creativity in how we deliver care. And it allows us to question some of our assumptions, such as the most visits in a day is the most productive physician. All of a sudden, we're asking, how can we help everybody understand that the most productive physician is one who keeps their patients healthy and out of the hospital?
Yeah, I fundamentally agree with that, Darren. UNC Health Alliance is a large integrated network.
What's that mean?
We have a lot of acronyms. An integrated network of 5,000 providers across the state, 7 hospitals, 13 different skilled nursing facilities, home health agencies, and I could expound on more. It's a network and a way for providers across the state to collaborate and coordinate care in different ways and in better ways that are really focused on, as Darren mentioned, good, solid patient outcomes. And what I wake up every day thinking and hoping is that today, the systems of care delivery that we're putting in place now will fundamentally improve a patient's life and will address what has been a barrier to good access to care for a long time for that patient and their family. This really has allowed us to focus on outcomes as opposed to more and more and more patients, more and more procedures, et cetera. This is fundamentally different way of thinking about delivering care and paying for it. It's hard. It's really hard. So the other thing I think about every day I wake up is how our providers are experiencing this new world and how our hospitals are experiencing this new world. Because to your point earlier, Brian, our rural hospitals have to stay open. So providing the payment mechanisms to allow that to happen as we're transforming is critically important in getting the right care to the right patient at the right time.
This is great. I'm getting excited about value-based care. I don't know about you, Adam, but it's...
I am excited. And I wonder if we were to fast forward 5 years from now, what's going to be different 5 years from now? Because it is a fundamental sea change out there, right? You're in the middle of it. And we know that the social determinants are so critical to patients' health. Does the value-based care help us address some of these fundamental issues that maybe we didn't address very well before?
We have to, because we do fundamentally know that the social determinants of health drive outcomes for patients, and often poor outcomes. And if we are now really focused on outcomes, on how improving outcomes can make healthcare more affordable across the board, then we have to pay more attention to those determinants. Providing access to transportation, looking at housing insecurity, untreated psychiatric disease or undertreated psychiatric disease, food insecurity, all of these are critically important to good patient outcomes, and developing models to not only screen for those barriers to care, but also addressing them, and now also partnering with community-based organizations that have been doing good work around all of those determinants of health for a long time. We now have a mechanism to start to bridge those gaps and those divides and coordinate between care providers in new and different ways. And that to me is really exciting.
Last word, Dr. DeWalt.
I think in the future, patients and doctors will have a clearer sense on what they're trying to accomplish together. And you will see a closer partnership between the patient and their doctor and the doctor's care team. And they will have more visits that are by phone or through video conferencing, Skype or FaceTime. And they'll be able to get in to see their doctor when they need to. I think that's how it's going to feel to deliver and receive health care.
So higher quality, higher satisfaction at a lower cost, that equation that you all outlined for us earlier.
Yes.
Well, as they say in my place of worship, from your mouth to God's ears. We've been talking with Dr. Mark Nguyen, president of the UNC Health Alliance, and Dr. Darren DeWalt, board chair of the UNC Health Alliance, and also professors at the University of North Carolina, about the promise and delivery and the reality of value-based care. Thank you for being our guest today on Your Health.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hope you'll come back sometime and give us an update.
Sounds good.
We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Brian Huggins. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions or concerns. If anyone has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send the comment or question to yourhealth@unc.edu. And I'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura?
I've had depression since I was 25, and it has been severe at times. It's been well managed for years with a combination of medications, but unfortunately the medications seem to take away all desire for sex. I'd really like to have a relationship that involves sexuality and intercourse, but I've tried going off the medication a couple times and the depression comes back. What sorts of things, if any, can you recommend?
First off, thank you for a sensitive question on an issue that probably is more common than probably doctors realize, other than maybe psychiatrists, and one in which, you know, I think we have to think about how we work on together as a team of professionals and maybe in collaboration with multiple disciplines.
Yes, that is exactly right. I think it's a very legitimate question. This looks like it's a side effect of the drugs or the medications that you're on, may or may not. But I don't recommend you coming off it. I think there should be a discussion between you and your doctor regarding if there are potential medications that we can switch to.
Yeah, and that may involve the primary care physician, the psychiatrist, a psychologist, because getting off those medicines clearly, and you've already alluded to this, it didn't work, and those medicines do have sexual side effects. And so then, you know, there's some questions, do you need to and should you have a testosterone check to make sure there's not some other medical condition going on? I think in some places and spaces, having a sex therapist can be helpful. People who specialize in helping people, just like a psychotherapist for depression, a sex therapist for people who are perhaps struggling with some of these issues, some of the medications that may be useful.
Yes, but we do want you to know that there are providers who know how to work this up properly, sequence by sequence, and you don't need to jump the gun and stop the medications.
Yes. So, you know, maybe finding out who is interested, who's willing to work with you, who's willing to work as a team together, starting by asking the question, just as you've done. Thank you so much. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I'm 70 years old, and when I went to see my new young physician, He seems surprised that I've been alcohol-free for nearly 40 years, despite being an alcoholic for close to 20 years before that. I think it's a good reminder to educate providers and the public that there are many people out there who are alive today who choose not to drink, and there are lots of resources to help people achieve that goal.
That's a powerful statement, and one that I'd say, hear, hear. Thank you so much. And I think that, you know, a lot of the younger doctors, their experience might be more limited in terms of what they've seen to really understand both how common alcohol addiction is and also how many people actually have been able to conquer it, because we tend to see the worst cases in medicine. We would tend to see those who haven't been successful.
Yes, that is true. We do see quite a bit who haven't been successful, but it's great to hear a story from somebody like you who has been able to conquer it.
One of the things that I think is important to know is there are some of the resources that exist to help. And I think the single best one probably across the world is Alcoholics Anonymous, AA, oldest reliable 12 steps, because they're actually one of the ways that's been proven to work. If people follow those steps, they get sponsors, they study, they do all the things, and they can help people lead better lives, both for those who are alcoholic, those who are family members of people who are alcoholic, called Al-Anon, and in general. They're good principles for living a good life.
Yes, and it has great success rates, as you just mentioned. But I do want you to know, the earlier the better. The earlier you realize that you have a problem, the more the success rate and the more the chances that you're going to prevent any complications from this.
Yeah, and I think we also read in one of our research that matters not too long ago about increasing numbers of people who are cutting back on their drinking and increasing number of people who actually don't drink. We are in a society, at least in the United States, where drinking seems to have so much resonance in social things that people have a hard time thinking, oh, could I go into social settings and not drink? And the answer is yes. That, I hope, is a norm for many people, because that is ultimately probably healthy for lots of us.
That's exactly right.
What's our very next house call?
Help me understand something.
Help you understand something.
That's okay. How it starts here.
Okay, good.
What is the difference between the Medicare wellness exam and a preventative medical exam? I know it seems like one of them cost me more money.
Well, I think you got it on the head there. But you know what? It's confusing for lots of patients. And actually, it's confusing for lots of providers. Confusing for you, Samir.
Yeah, I was embarrassed. But even I was kind of confused about what that means.
Yeah, so let's try to clear it up and not do more damage. The Medicare wellness exam is a benefit provided by Medicare, which basically says you can get once a year talking with someone to talk about wellness. So the work that you have done in preventive medicine, so advocating for a good diet and physical activity and, you know, which shots you may need. And it doesn't have to be a doctor. It can be anyone who's qualified in the healthcare setting. And that type of advice is done free, and they call it a Medicare wellness exam. The problem is that frequently patients who come in and they want their Medicare wellness exam doesn't really have a whole lot of physical examination things that are done. But if you come in and you want a full physical exam and you have any health condition like diabetes or high blood pressure or high lipids or smoking or depression or asthma or arthritis, I think that there's a lot of people, particularly elderly people, those things aren't included in a Medicare wellness. And so those sort of things are really your annual examination, a preventive examination that may be done that you would actually have to oftentimes have a copay. If you have health insurance, it would be covered fully, but there may well be a copay, particularly if you have to get advice about medications for the diabetes or high blood pressure. It's much more involved. So think about it. You don't have any health problems and you just want to get some wellness advice, that Medicare wellness, if you're the right age, would be a way of going. If you got any health problems, it's probably not going to work.
That all makes sense to me. Hopefully that all makes sense to the audiences as well.
We're going to ask again our health science librarians to put up a little chart showing the distinction between those two, and we want to thank them in advance for all of their work. Well, that'll conclude your health today, and we want to thank all of you for joining us. We hope we've addressed issues that are important to your health and staying healthy. You can send us any questions or comments at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. I want to thank our guest co-host today, Dr. Samir Arora, as well as our guest today, Dr. Mark Gwynn and Dr. Darren DeWalt and Dr. Brian Huggins, who helped out with that interview. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we'll look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.